9. Indirect narration, or what tells. A. Lower the t'gallants. B. I will when I find them. This chapter has to do with various aspects of storytelling that don't seem to be storytelling in the obvious sense of recounting events. Some people interpret story to mean plot. Some reduce story to action. Plot is so much discussed in literature and writing courses, and action is so highly valued, that I want to put in a counterweight opinion. A story that has nothing but action and plot is a pretty poor affair, and some great stories have neither. To my mind, plot is merely one way of telling a story, by connecting the happenings tightly, usually through causal chains. Plot is a marvelous device, but it's not superior to story, and not even necessary to it. As for action, indeed, a story must move, something must happen. But the action can be nothing more than a letter sent that doesn't arrive, a thought unspoken, the passage of a summer day. Unceasing violent action is usually a sign that, in fact, no story is being told. In E. M. Forster's Aspects of the Novel, which I've loved and argued with for years, is a famous illustration of story. The king died, and then the queen died. And plot. The king died, and then the queen died of grief. My opinion is that those are both rudimentary stories, the first loose, the second slightly structured. Neither one has or is a plot. When the king's brother murdered the king and married the queen, the crown prince was upset. Now, there's a plot, one you may recognize, in fact. There are a limited number of plots. Some say 7, some say 12, some say 30. There is no limit to the number of stories. Everybody in the world has their story. Every meeting of one person with another may begin a story. Somebody asked Willie Nelson where he got his songs, and he said, "The air's full of melodies. You just reach out." The world's full of stories. You just reach out. I say this in an attempt to unhook people from the idea that they have to make an elaborate plan of a tight plot before they're allowed to write a story. If that's the way you like to write, write that way, of course. But if it isn't, if you aren't a planner or a plotter, don't worry. The world's full of stories. All you need may be a character or two, or a conversation, or a situation, or a place, and you'll find the story there. You think about it. You work it out at least partly before you start writing, so that you know in a general way where you're going. But the rest works itself out in the telling. I like my image of steering the craft, but in fact, the storyboat is a magic one. It knows its course. The job of the person at the helm is to help it find its own way to wherever it's going. In this chapter, we're also dealing with how to provide information in a narrative. This is a skill science fiction and fantasy writers are keenly aware of, because they often have a great deal of information to convey that the reader has no way of knowing unless told. If my story's set in Chicago in 2005, I can assume that my readers have some general idea of the time and place and how things were, and can fill in the picture from the barest hints. But if my story's set on 4 Beta Draconis in 3205, my readers have no idea what to expect, The world of the story must be created and explained in the story. This is part of the particular interest and beauty of science fiction and fantasy. Writer and reader collaborate in world-making. But it's a tricky business. If the information is poured out as a lecture, barely concealed by some stupid device... Oh, Captain, do tell me how the antimatter dissimulator works. And then he does, endlessly. We have what science fiction writers call an expository lump. Crafty writers, in any genre, don't allow exposition to form lumps. They break up the information, grind it fine, and make it into bricks to build the story with. Almost all narrative carries some load of explaining and describing. This expository freight can be as much a problem in memoir as it is in science fiction. Making the information part of the story is a learnable skill. As always, a good part of the solution consists simply in being aware that there is a problem. So, in this chapter, we're dealing with stories that tell us things without appearing to be telling us. We're practicing invisible exposition. The first exercise is a stark and simple one. Exercise 9, Telling It Slant. Part 1, A and B. The goal of this exercise is to tell a story and present two characters through dialogue alone. Write a page or two. Word count would be misleading, as dialogue leaves a lot of unfilled lines. A page or two of pure dialogue. Write it like a play, with A and B as the characters' names. No stage directions. No description of the characters. Nothing but what A says and what B says. Everything the reader knows about who they are, where they are, and what's going on comes through what they say. If you want a suggestion for the topic, put two people into some kind of crisis situation. The car just ran out of gas. The spaceship is about to crash. The doctor has just realized that the old man she's treating for a heart attack is her father. Note, A and B is not an exercise in writing a short story. It's an exercise in one of the elements of storytelling. You may, in fact, come out with a quite satisfactory little playlet or performance piece, but the technique is not one to use much or often in narrative prose. Critiquing. If you're working in a group, this is a good exercise to write in class. You'll probably find that people mutter a good deal as they write it. If the text's clear enough for another person to read, when you come to reading it aloud, it's good fun for the author to be A and somebody else to be B after a silent read-through. If you're very brave, give your piece to two other people to read aloud. If they're pretty good readers, you may learn quite a lot about how to fix it from how they read it, noticing where they stumble or mistake the emphasis and how natural or stagey it sounds. If you're working by yourself, read it out loud, not whispering, out loud. In discussing or thinking about it, you may want to consider the effectiveness of the device as such. It is a tiny drama, after all. You might also think about these matters. Is the story clear? Do we learn enough about the people and the situation? Do we need more information or less? What do we, in fact, know about the people? For example, do we know their gender? What do we feel about them? Could we tell the two voices apart without the A and B signals? And if not, how might they be more differentiated? Do people actually talk this way? Later on, A and B is a permanently useful exercise, like chastity. If you haven't anything better to do, you can always stick A and B in a car in the middle of Nevada, or whatever, and see what they say. Do remember, though, that unless you're a playwright, the result isn't what you want. It's only an element of what you want. Actors embody and recreate the words of drama. In fiction, a tremendous amount of story and character may be given through the dialogue, but the story world and its people have to be created by the storyteller. If there's nothing in it but dialogue, disembodied voices, too much is missing. Polyphony. All the same, I'm going on with voices for a while. One of the marvelous things about that marvelous thing, the novel, is its many-voicedness, its polyphony. All kinds of people get to think, feel, and talk in a novel, and that great psychological variety is a part of the vitality and beauty of the form. It might seem that the writer needs a gift of mimicry, like an impersonator, to achieve this variety of voices. But it isn't that. It's more like what a serious actor does, sinking self in character self. It's a willingness to be the characters, letting what they think and say rise from inside them. It's a willingness to share control with one's creation. Writers may need conscious practice in writing in voices that aren't their own. They may even resist it. Memoirists may write only in one voice, their own. But if all the people in the memoir say only what the author wants them to say, all we hear is the author speaking, an interminable, unconvincing monologue. Some fiction writers do the same thing. They use their characters as mouthpieces for what they want to say or hear. And so you get the story where everybody talks alike, and the characters are nothing but little megaphones for the author. What's needed in this case is conscious and serious practice in hearing and using and being used by other people's voices. Instead of talking, let other people talk through you. I can't tell a memoir writer how to do this because I don't know how to listen for an actual voice and reproduce it truly. It's not a skill I ever practiced. I admire it in awe. Perhaps one way to begin practicing it would be to listen to people on the bus, in the supermarket, in the waiting room, and try to remember and write down their talk later as a private exercise in fidelity to real voice. If you're a fiction writer, though, I can tell you how to let people talk through you. Listen. Just be quiet and listen. Let the character talk. Don't censor. Don't control. Listen and write. Don't be afraid of doing this. After all, you are in control. These characters are entirely dependent on you. You made them up. Let the poor fictive creatures have their say. You can hit delete anytime you like. Exercise 9, Part 2. Being the Stranger. Write a narrative of 200 to 600 words, a scene involving at least two people and some kind of action or event. Use a single viewpoint character in either first person or limited third person. Who is involved in the event? Give us the character's thoughts and feelings in their own words. The viewpoint character, real or invented, is to be somebody you dislike or disapprove of, or hate, or feel to be extremely different from yourself. The situation might be a quarrel between neighbors, or a relative's visit, or somebody acting weird at the checkout counter. Whatever will show the viewpoint character doing what that person does, thinking what that person thinks. To think about before writing. When I say the stranger, someone extremely different from yourself, I mean it in the psychological sense, somebody you don't empathize or sympathize with easily. A person who is profoundly different from you socially, culturally, by language, by nation, may in fact not be accessible to you as a character. You may really not know enough about their life to write about them from inside. My advice is stick close to home. There are strangers everywhere. For some writers who have never practiced this sort of psychological displacement, it can be hard and scary just to change gender, to write as a person of the opposite sex. If this applies to you, do it. Many young writers have never tried to write as an old person, old being anything over 30. If this applies to you, do it. Many writers, even old ones, write of family relationships always as the child, never as a parent. If this applies to you, try writing as one of the parental, not the child, generation. If you usually write about a certain kind of person, write about a totally different kind of person. If you mostly write fiction, you might make this an exercise in memoir. Revive a memory of a person you have disliked or held in contempt or felt to be very alien to you. Take a moment you recall and tell it from that person's POV, trying to guess how they felt, what they saw, why they said what they said. How did they perceive you? If you mostly write memoir, you might make this an exercise in fiction. Invent a person who is truly different from yourself, who's not sympathetic to you. Get inside that person's skin, think, and feel as they do. Note, if you're recalling actual events, don't use this exercise to rouse up sleeping demons. It's not therapy. It's just an exercise, though it's in an important aspect of writing, which does demand a certain courage of the writer. You can use this exercise satirically, hatefully, showing us how awful the viewpoint character is by exposing what they really think and feel. That is a legitimate and canny writing tactic, but it defeats the purpose of the exercise, which is to suspend your judgment on this person. What the exercise asks of you is to walk a mile in their moccasins, seeing the world through their eyes. In critiquing, you might use this last suggestion as a criterion. As readers, are we really inside the viewpoint character so that we understand something about how they see the world? Or did the writer stay outside, sitting in judgment, trying to force us to make the same judgment? If there's spitefulness, vindictiveness in the piece, whose is it? Another approach. Is the voice the piece is told in a convincing one? Are there particular places where it rings false or rings true? Can you discuss with others or with yourself, why this is so? Thinking about it afterward, you might consider why you chose the person you chose as the viewpoint character, and you might consider whether you found out anything about yourself as a writer, about your way of handling characters, Will you try again to write in a voice very different from your own? Now, to get away from voices entirely for a while, Part 3 of Exercise 9 is just like Part 1, except it's the opposite. In A and B, you had nothing but voices to work with, no scenery at all. In this one, you have nothing to work with but the scenery. Nobody's there, and nothing, apparently, is happening. Before doing this one, you might want to read examples 15, 16, and 17. The description of Jacob's room at college is light in tone, seeming not very significant. Yet the name of the book is Jacob's Room. And when we come to the end of that book, on the last page, the last two sentences of this little description are repeated word for word with an utterly different, heartbreaking resonance. Oh, the power of repetition. Example 15. Virginia Woolf from Jacob's Room. The feathery white moon never let the sky grow dark. All night, the chestnut blossoms were white in the green. Dim was the cow parsley in the meadows. The waiters at Trinity must have been shuffling china plates like cards from the clatter that could be heard in the great court. Jacob's rooms, however, were in Neville's court, at the top, so that reaching his door, one went in a little out of breath. But he wasn't there. Dining in hall, presumably. It will be quite dark in Neville's court long before midnight. Only the pillars opposite will always be white. And the fountains. A curious effect the gate has, like lace upon pale green. Even in the window you hear the plates. A hum of talk, too, from the diners. The hall lit up, and the swing doors opening and shutting with a soft thud. Some are late. Jacob's room had a round table and two low chairs. There were yellow flags in a jar on the mantelpiece, a photograph of his mother, cards from societies with little raised crescents, coats of arms and initials, notes and pipes. On the table lay paper ruled with a red margin, an essay, no doubt. Does history consist of the biographies of great men? There were books enough. Very few French books, but then anyone who's worth anything reads just what he likes, as the mood takes him, with extravagant enthusiasm. Lives of the Duke of Wellington, for example, Spinoza, the works of Dickens, the Fairy Queen, a Greek dictionary with the petals of poppies pressed to silk between the pages, all the Elizabethans. His slippers were incredibly shabby, like boats burnt to the water's rim. Then there were photographs from the Greeks, and a mezzotint from Sir Joshua. All very English. The works of Jane Austen, too, in deference, perhaps, to someone else's standard. Carlyle was a prize. There were books upon the Italian painters of the Renaissance, a manual of the diseases of the horse, and all the usual textbooks. Listless is the air in an empty room, just swelling the curtain. The flowers in the jar shift. One fiber in the wicker armchair creaks, though no one sits there. The next example is the famous opening of Hardy's The Return of the Native. There are no characters in the first chapter at all, except Egdon Heath. Hardy's prose is circuitous and heavy-footed, and one really needs to read the whole chapter to feel how tremendously he sets the scene. If you go on and read the whole book, The character you may remember most clearly from it, years after, is still Egdon Heath. Example 16. Thomas Hardy from The Return of the Native. A Saturday afternoon in November was approaching the time of twilight, and the vast tract of unenclosed wild, known as Egdon Heath, embrowned itself moment by moment. Overhead, the hollow stretch of whitish cloud shutting out the sky was as a tent, which had the whole heath for its floor. The heaven being spread with this pallid screen, and the earth with the darkest vegetation, their meeting line at the horizon was clearly marked. In such contrast, the heath wore the appearance of an installment of night which had taken up its place before its astronomical hour was come. Darkness had, to a great extent, arrived hereon, while day stood distinct in the sky. Looking upwards, a furze cutter would have been inclined to continue work. Looking down, he would have decided to finish his faggot and go home. The distant rims of the world and of the firmament seemed to be a division in time, no less than a division in matter. The face of the heath, by its mere complexion, added half an hour to evening. It could, in like manner, retard the dawn, sadden noon, anticipate the frowning of storms scarcely generated, and intensify the opacity of a moonless midnight to a cause of shaking and dread. In fact, precisely at this transitional point of its nightly roll into darkness, the great and particular glory of the Egdon Waste began. And nobody could be said to understand the heath who had not been there at such a time. It could best be felt when it could not clearly be seen, its complete effect and explanation lying in this and the succeeding hours before the next dawn. Then, and only then, did it tell its true tale. The spot was, indeed, a near relation of night, and when night showed itself an apparent tendency to gravitate together, could be perceived in its shades and the scene. The somber stretch of rounds and hollows seemed to rise and meet the evening gloom in pure sympathy, the heath exhaling darkness as rapidly as the heavens precipitated it. And so the obscurity in the air and the obscurity in the land closed together in a black fraternization towards which each advanced halfway. The place became full of a watchful intentness now, for when other things sank brooding to sleep, the heath appeared slowly to awake and listen. Every night, its titanic form seemed to await something, but it had waited thus, unmoved, during so many centuries, through the crises of so many things, that it could only be imagined to await one last crisis, the final overthrow. We follow Jane Eyre in her first tour of Thornfield Hall. These rooms aren't empty, as Jane and the housekeeper pass through them, talking. But the power of the piece is in the description of the furnishings, the rooftop, and its wide, bright view, the sudden return to the dim passages of the third story, and then the laugh Jane hears. It was a curious laugh, distinct, formal, mirthless. Oh, the power of the right adjectives. Example 17. Charlotte Bronte. From Jane Eyre. When we left the dining room, she proposed to show me over the rest of the house, and I followed her upstairs and downstairs, admiring as I went, for all was well arranged and handsome. The large front chambers I thought especially grand, and some of the third-story rooms, though dark and low, were interesting from their air of antiquity. The furniture, once appropriated to the lower apartments, had from time to time been removed here, as fashions changed. And the imperfect light entering by the narrow casement showed bedsteads of 100 years old, chests in oak or walnut, looking, with their strange carvings of palm branches and cherubs' heads, like types of the Hebrew Ark. Rows of venerable chairs, high-backed and narrow. Stools, still more antiquated, on whose cushioned tops were yet apparent traces of half-effaced embroideries, wrought by fingers that for 2 generations had been coffin dust. All these relics gave to the third story of Thornfield Hall the aspect of a home of the past, a shrine of memory. I liked the hush, the gloom, the quaintness of these retreats in the day, but I by no means coveted a night's repose on one of those wide and heavy beds, shut in, some of them, with doors of oak, shaded, others, with wrought old English hangings crusted with thick work, portraying effigies of strange flowers and stranger birds and strangest human beings, all which would have looked strange indeed by the pallid gleam of moonlight. "Do the servants sleep in these rooms?" I asked. "No, they occupy a range of smaller apartments to the back. No one ever sleeps here. One would almost say that if there were a ghost at Thornfield Hall, this would be its haunt." "So I think you have no ghost, then?" "None that I ever heard of," returned Mrs. Fairfax, smiling. "Nor any traditions of one? No legends or ghost stories?" "I believe not. And yet it is said the Rochesters have been rather a violent than a quiet race in their time. Perhaps, though, that is the reason they rest tranquilly in their graves now." "Yes. After life's fitful fever, they sleep well," I muttered. "Where are you going now, Mrs. Fairfax?" For she was moving away. "On to the Leads. Will you come and see the view from thence?" I followed still, up a very narrow staircase to the attics, and thence by a ladder and through a trapdoor to the roof of the hall. I was now on a level with the crow colony and could see into their nests. Leaning over the battlements and looking far down, I surveyed the grounds laid out like a map, the bright and velvet lawn closely girdling the gray base of the mansion. The field, wide as a park, dotted with its ancient timber. The wood, dun and sere, divided by a path visibly overgrown, greener with moss than the trees were with foliage. The church at the gates, the road, the tranquil hills, all reposing in the autumn day's sun, the horizon bounded by a propitious sky, azure, marbled with pearly white. No feature in the scene was extraordinary, but all was pleasing. When I turned from it and repassed the trapdoor, I could scarcely see my way down the ladder. The attic seemed black as a vault compared with that arch of blue air to which I had been looking up, and to that sunlit scene of grove, pasture, and green hill, of which the hall was the center, and over which I had been gazing with delight. Mrs. Fairfax stayed behind a moment to fasten the trap door. I, by dint of groping, found the outlet from the attic and proceeded to descend the narrow garret staircase. I lingered in the long passage to which this led, separating the front and back rooms of the third story, narrow, low, and dim, with only one little window at the far end, and looking, with its two rows of small black doors, all shut, like a corridor in some Bluebeard's castle. While I paced softly on, the last sound I expected to hear in so still a region, a laugh, struck my ear. It was a curious laugh, distinct, formal, mirthless. I stopped. The sound ceased, only for an instant. It began again, louder, for at first, though distinct, it was very low. It passed off in a clamorous peal that seemed to wake an echo in every lonely chamber, though it originated but in one, and I could have pointed out the door whence the accents issued. Further reading. All the examples quoted are fairly direct in their description, yet they do not slow or stop the story. The story is in the scene, in the things described. There's a tendency to fear descriptive passages, as if they were unnecessary ornaments that inevitably slow the action. To see how a landscape and a great deal of information about people and a way of life can be the action, the onward movement of the story, look at Linda Hogan's Solar Storms, Leslie Marmon Silko's Ceremony, or Esmeralda Santiago's memoir, When I Was Puerto Rican. In well-written, serious thrillers, such as John le Carré's The Tailor of Panama, information about the setting, about politics, and so on, is in the same way integral to the story. Good mysteries are good at conveying information, too, from Dorothy Sayers' classic Murder Must Advertise, and The Nine Tailors, on. In a fantasy such as Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, a whole world is created and explained, effortlessly and joyously, through a wealth of vivid, concrete detail, as the story moves unceasingly forward. I believe there is no moment in that immense book in which the reader doesn't know exactly where the characters are, and what the weather is doing. Science fiction, as I said, specializes in getting a considerable amount of information to function as part of the narrative. Vonda N. McIntyre's The Moon and the Sun tells you more about the splendid court and eccentric courtiers of Louis XIV than many history books do, and it's all dazzling story. Good history is all story, too. Look at Hubert Herring's great Latin America, and marvel at how he worked 20 countries and 500 years into a real page-turner. Stephen Jay Gould is a master at embedding complex scientific information and theory in strong narrative essays. Memoirists often seem a little old-fashioned in separating description from story. Like Walter Scott back in the early 19th century, they show us a scene and then relate what happened there. But such deeply placed books as Mary Austin's Land of Little Rain, Isaac Dinesen's Out of Africa, and W. H. Hudson's The Purple Land weave scenery, characters, and emotions into one rich and seamless fabric. In autobiographies, such as those by Frederick Douglass, Sarah Winnemucca, Maxine Hong Kingston, Jill Kerr Conway, and in masterful biographies, such as Winifred Gerard's of the Brontes, or Hermione Lee's of Virginia Woolf, the narrative carries effortlessly a wealth of information about the times, the places, the events of a life, which give the story a depth and solidity any novelist may envy. Perhaps the most masterly example I know of interweaving complex factual and technical information with a fascinating, deeply felt narrative involving many people over many years is Rebecca Skloot's The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Exercise 9, Part 3. implication. Each part of this should involve 200 to 600 words of descriptive prose. In both, the voice is either involved author or detached author. No viewpoint character. Character by indirection. Describe a character by describing any place inhabited or frequented by that character. A room, house, garden, office, studio, bed, whatever. The character isn't present at the time. The untold event. Give us a glimpse of the mood and nature of some event or deed by describing the place. Room, rooftop, street, park, landscape, whatever. Where it happened or is about to happen. The event or deed doesn't happen in your piece. You aren't to say anything directly about the person or the event, which is, in fact, the subject of the piece. This is the stage without the actors on it. This is the camera panning before the action starts. And this kind of suggestion is something words can do better than any other medium, even film. Use any props you like. Furniture, clothes, belongings, weather, climate, a period in history, plants, rocks, smells, sounds, anything. Work the pathetic fallacy for all it's worth. Focus on any item or detail that reveals the character or that suggests what happened or will happen. Remember, this is a narrative device, part of a story. Everything you describe is there in order to further that story. Give us evidences that build up into a consistent, coherent mood or atmosphere from which we can infer or glimpse or intuit the absent person or the untold act. A mere inventory of articles won't do it and will bore the reader. Every detail must tell. If you find implication an interesting exercise, you can repeat either or both parts. This time, instead of the authorial voice, use the voice of a character in the story to describe the scene. Note, in descriptive writing, give a thought from time to time to the senses other than sight. Sound, above all, is evocative. We have a limited vocabulary for smell, but mention of a certain scent or stink can set a feeling tone. Taste and touch are forbidden to the detached author. The involved author can go around telling us how things feel to the hand, though I don't think even an involved author gets to actually eat the fruit that looks so fresh and delicious, or has gotten so moldy in the shining or the dusty wooden bowl. But if a character in the story is telling it, all senses can come into play. Optional additions to Exercise 9. The Expository Lump. My workshoppers were interested in the concept of the expository lump, as any writer must be, and they wanted an exercise specifically aimed at it. I said I couldn't think of one. They said, "You make up some information that we have to work into a narrative." A delightful idea. I get to invent stuff, and you have to do all the hard work. As my knowledge of the real world is sketchy, I provide a fantasy subject. Don't be afraid. It's just an exercise. You can return to the real world immediately after and forever. Option 1. The Fantastic Lump. Study this piece of false history and invented information till you're familiar with it. Then use it as the foundation of a story or a scene. As you write the scene, compost the information, break it up, spread it out, slip it into conversation or action narration or anywhere you can make it go so it doesn't feel lumpy. Tell it by implication, by passing reference, by hint, by any means you like. Tell it so that readers don't realize they're learning anything. Include enough of it that readers can fully understand the situation the Queen is in. This will take, I think, 2 or 3 pages, possibly more. The kingdom of Harith used to be ruled by queens, but for a century men have ruled and women are not permitted to. 20 years ago, young King Pell disappeared in a battle on the border of the kingdom with the Yenedi, who are magicians. The people of Harith have never practiced magic, as their religion declares it to be against the will of the 9 goddesses. What became of King Pell is not known. He left a wife, but no known heir. Claimants to his throne have all been defeated by Lord Jussa, the queen's guardian, but the struggles of these factions have left the kingdom impoverished and unhappy. At the time of our story, the Yenedi are threatening to invade on the eastern border. Lord Jussa is keeping the queen, a woman of 40, imprisoned in a remote tower under the pretext of keeping her safe. In fact, he is afraid of her and alarmed by rumors of a mysterious person who managed to visit her secretly while she was in the palace. This person might be the leader of a rebel faction who is said to be the queen's illegitimate child. Or it might be King Pell. Or it might be an Yenedi magician. Or... you take it from there. You don't have to write the whole story, just a scene or two that is based on this information, and includes enough of it to be understandable to a reader who has not read the information. The tower where the queen is being held is a good place to start. Use any viewpoint you like. You get to name the queen. Option 2, the real lump. I thought this one up with memoir writers in mind. Because it deals with actual experience, I can't provide the material for you. Think of something you know how to do that involves a complex series of specific actions. For example, making a loaf of bread, making a piece of jewelry, building a barn, designing a costume, playing a game of blackjack or a game of polo, sailing a boat, repairing an engine, setting up a conference, setting a broken wrist, setting type. It should be something that not everybody knows how to do, so that most readers will want some explanation of the procedures. If nothing comes to mind, find an encyclopedia and look up a process. Maybe something you always wondered about, how to make paper by hand, how to bind a book, how to shoe a horse, whatever. You'll have to use your imagination to supply the sensory details that will keep the description vivid. Industrial processes are almost certainly too complicated to bone up on in this way. But if you already have knowledge of one, there's an excellent subject. Write a scene involving at least 2 people in which this process is going on, either in the background of a conversation or as the locus of the action. Keep the description specific and concrete. Avoid jargon, but if the process has a lingo of its own, use it. Whatever the process is, make the various steps clear to the reader. But don't let it appear to be what the piece is all about.